Hi, I'm April Fulton.
And I'm Rebecca Davis, and this is Your Health, the weekly podcast from NPR Science Desk.
On today's show, new technology gives speech to the speechless.
And in Florida, drug dealers are working out of strip malls.
And American pediatricians are the latest group to warn teens about tanning salons. We'll discuss tanning and a few other stories with our health blogger, Scott Hensley.
But first, millions of women are affected by osteoporosis. It's a common disease that makes bones brittle. For the past 15 years, women have been able to take drugs that fight osteoporosis and prevent fractures.
But in the last couple of years, specialists have begun to worry that long-term use of these drugs may actually cause an unusual kind of fracture. NPR's Richard Knox has one woman's story.
Jennifer Schneider was one of the first women to suffer one of these nasty, unusual fractures. Or at least her case was one of the first reported in a medical journal.
I could hear it and I could feel it. I knew it was broken instantly.
It was her right leg. It happened when she was riding a subway train in New York City.
As the train approached a station, it jolted, and I shifted my weight from one leg to the other, and I felt my leg cracking.
Schneider's thigh bone had snapped in two, just at the part that's usually the strongest.
I could not understand how this possibly could have happened from standing on a train.
Surgeons installed a metal rod to hold her shattered thigh bone together, but after many months, the bone just wasn't healing. Now, Schneider is a doctor herself, and one of the things she started suspecting was an osteoporosis drug she'd been on for 7 years. It's called Fosamax. It works by slowing down bone metabolism, the building of new bone that doctors call turnover.
Since you need bone turnover in order to heal a fractured bone, continuing to take this drug might in fact inhibit bone healing.
So Schneider decided to stop taking Fosamax, and eventually the fracture healed. But after 2 years off the drug, tests showed her bones were thinning, and doctors urged Schneider to go back on Fosamax.
I did go back on it, and within a year, I had a stress fracture of a metatarsal, which is a bone in the foot, and so I stopped the drug and never went back to it.
Schneider decided to write herself up as a case report in the journal Geriatrics. Her report challenged the idea that women should keep taking these drugs for the rest of their lives. When Schneider wrote that 5 years ago, many doctors scoffed at her claim that the drug was responsible. But last week, the Journal of the American Medical Association published a large study done in Canada that suggests long-term use of these osteoporosis drugs does raise the risk of unusual thigh bone fractures. In fact, women who'd been on the drugs more than 5 years had nearly three times higher risk. Dr. Jillian Hawker of St. Michael's Hospital in Toronto worked on the study.
Although the number of fractures of these unusual fractures was pretty small, they were pretty rare, it nonetheless did show a relationship with longer-term use.
Pretty rare, but since tens of millions of women are on the drugs, the study suggests that thousands of them may suffer these devastating fractures every year. But here's the dilemma. Many women need these drugs because they really do work to prevent regular hip fractures caused by osteoporosis.
Hip fracture is a horrible, horrible event, period. Very, very devastating and often an end-of-life event.
So the drugs are necessary, but Hawker says not all older women should be treated.
You know, I'm in my early 50s, and my mother and all my friends' mothers have horrible osteoporosis, multiple fractures, and that is really preventable in 2011. That's wonderful. But in the heyday of the early days when we all got excited about these medications, I think a lot of people who really probably didn't need to be on them went on them.
Schneider, the doctor who broke her leg on the subway, says she's one of those women. When the drugs were first approved, many doctors thought women would be better off if they started on an osteoporosis drug before developing serious bone loss. Schneider began taking Fosamax on the basis of a bone density scan that showed some age-related thinning, but not enough to be called osteoporosis. Now she thinks that was a mistake.
We should not be so ready to put patients on these drugs as soon as their bone density starts dropping.
A growing number of experts agree. Dr. Cliff Rosen at Maine Medical Center in Portland says now specialists are worried about the risk of unusual thigh bone fractures.
These kind of fractures, which, you know, are uncommon, but we've all seen them, now raises this specter that, gee, you know, we really need to rethink who we treat, when we treat, and how long we treat.
There's evidence that 5 years on these drugs may be good enough to prevent regular osteoporosis fractures, and taking a break at that point may be a good idea. Rosen says the take-home message is don't start one of these drugs too early. Wait until you actually have osteoporosis. And once you start, don't stay on it too long. Richard Knox, NPR News.
Florida has become the epicenter for a drug epidemic, one that involves abusing prescription drugs. Each day in Florida, thousands of doses of powerful narcotics like oxycodone are freely dispensed from storefront clinics called pill mills.
Federal, state, and local authorities are working to drive them out of Florida. But as NPR's Greg Allen reports from Miami, a key person is standing in the way, and that's Florida Governor Rick Scott.
Al Lamberti says when he started at the Broward County Sheriff's Department 30 years ago, the department was raiding crack houses and busting junkies.
Nowadays, the drug dealers are working out of strip malls.
Lamberti now heads the sheriff's office in a county that includes Fort Lauderdale, a city that's become a destination not just for spring breakers, but also for addicts and drug traffickers.
We have more pain clinics in Broward County than Starbucks. We have more pain clinics than McDonald's. They're taking their toll.
Lamberti spoke at a news conference where he was joined by a dozen federal, state, and local law enforcement officials. They were there to announce a major crackdown on Florida's pill mills, including more than 20 arrests and the seizure of more than $22 million in cash, exotic cars, and real estate. Doctors in Florida prescribe 10 times more oxycodone pills than every other state in the country combined. People come from all over the southeastern U.S. to see pain clinic doctors, who give them a quick exam, a prescription for a powerful painkiller, sometimes even filling the prescription on the premises. DEA Special Agent Mark Truville said over the past year, the joint law enforcement operation has made more than 300 undercover drug buys from pain clinics, and more arrests are coming.
So if you're a clinic owner or a doctor or an employee knowingly working at one of these illegal pill mills, we have probably bought dope from you, and we are probably coming to see you soon.
Truville said one reason pill mills have proliferated here is because Florida, unlike most other states, lacks a system for monitoring drug prescriptions. That would help prevent doctor shopping, people who travel from one clinic to another buying hundreds of doses of prescription drugs. In fact, Florida does have a prescription drug database. After years of lobbying by law enforcement, the state legislature passed a bill last session to create one. But it didn't provide money to pay for it. A private foundation stepped in and began raising funds for the database. But recently, a leading state official has come out foursquare against it. Florida's Governor Rick Scott.
I don't support the database. I believe it's an invasion of privacy, and I believe that, one, it appears that the money's been wasted.
An official with the Prescription Drug Monitoring Program Foundation says the governor's accusation is false and that the group has already raised enough money to start up the state database. In the last few weeks, a growing number of voices, both in Florida and outside the state, have called on Scott to drop his opposition to the drug monitoring program. Many of Scott's critics come from states with their own oxycodone epidemics, fueled by addicts and drug traffickers who make regular visits to Florida. It's a trip down Interstate 75 some now call the Oxy Express. Kentucky's Lieutenant Governor Daniel Mongiardo is also a surgeon.
I have friends that are ER doctors along I-75, and it's a daily basis where somebody goes into an ER off I-75 with an overdose. We had a 41-year-old mother who was in the back seat of a car coming back from Florida who overdosed and she died.
In Florida, law enforcement authorities say the crackdown on pill mills will continue, but that they can't arrest their way out of the problem. They're calling for stricter regulation of doctors and funding for the statewide drug database. Now all they have to do is convince the governor. Greg Allen, NPR News, Miami.
And now let's catch up with our health blogger, Scott Hensley.
You better put that BlackBerry down. We want your full attention
today.
It's
down. It's down.
Scott, you put a post up this week that was about the consequences of taking prescription painkillers on unborn babies.
That's right. It's from Nancy Shute, who's been writing for the blog quite a bit lately. And Nancy wrote a post about an analysis from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention that looked at decades worth of data on what's happening with birth defects and drug use. And the bad news is that there is a small, it's small, but real increase in birth defects that could be tied to the use of these heavy-duty prescription painkillers like the ones we just heard about.
Now, what kind of birth defects are we talking about here?
The one where there was the greatest increase had to do with a malformation of the heart, and then there were some others that were related to the nervous system.
Okay.
Nancy tells everyone this is something that some women who are pregnant may not know about. They ought to be aware of it, talk to their doctors about the kinds of medicines that they're taking. It's not a humongous risk, but it's one that could be avoided and that people should avoid if they can. Hmm.
Scott, you had another post which I really focused in on, which is about children and fevers. And there was a warning for parents not to be so quick about using fever medications, fever reducers.
Yes, indeed. And this is a problem in my own house. It seems to be a
right
chronic
now.
One. Everybody in the house is sick, including
right.
both my kids. And I got this under embargo, and I talked with my wife about it, but didn't reveal the source until we published.
Now we know.
Now we know. But anyway, the American Academy of Pediatrics put out a report basically cautioning against fever phobia, getting so fixated on a kid running a temperature that you give him or her too much medicine. Ibuprofen or acetaminophen, Tylenol, are the most common things that parents would give kids to fight a fever. And what the pediatricians say is, parents, a lot of you are doing this too soon.
Okay, so when should you start giving your child fever reducer? Is there a magic number?
There is not a magic number. What the doctors say is you should be thinking about the symptoms of the child. If the child is so uncomfortable because of the fever that it's interfering with their ability to sleep or other problems, then yes, go ahead and do it. Don't wake the kid up to give them a fever reducer. It turns out a lot of parents do this, and the pediatricians say that's just not necessary, not a good idea. One number, I know you want a number, so here's the number that I'm going to get out there. A temperature below 100.4 degrees Fahrenheit isn't a fever. Our temperatures fluctuate all during the day. Kid could be a little warm but not have a fever. The pediatricians say probably doesn't make sense to even think about giving a kid with a temperature lower than 100.4 one of these fever reducers.
And yet if they're getting a fever that's getting like 104, wouldn't you start to get a little concerned?
I think that's a time when you would naturally want to call your doctor. I'm not about to dispense that kind of medical device, medical advice, excuse me. What I would say is, in paraphrasing and summarizing what they said, it's at the lower end where they think there's a lot of overtreatment. These drugs are not super risky, but they do carry risks, and it's something that the pediatricians are warning parents, or advising parents and doctors, look, take it easy on this. Rebecca, you and I were talking about this a little earlier in the week. Fevers have a, they're part of the body's response to infection. You know, it's not the illness. The fever is a reaction. The body is heating up to try and drive out the viruses and the bacteria. So
it has a good purpose.
Yeah, it has a good purpose. And the doctors say, you know, you don't want to completely squash that.
Okay.
Well, speaking of heating up, we get them through their fevers, and then they become teenagers, and they want to go get hot in the tanning bed.
Good idea. Thumbs up.
It's another Nancy Shoot special.
Yeah.
Let's give credit where it's due. And pediatricians, this was in the same issue of the journal Pediatrics. They're calling for a ban on minors, teens mostly, getting using tanning salons. And there's a increased risk of skin cancer from this kind of exposure. And the doctors say there's absolutely no way this could be a benefit. Why are we letting teens do this? And they want it stopped.
And if I can just quote something actually from Nancy's post, she cited a study that was published last year that showed that people who use tanning beds have a 74% higher risk of melanoma than those who don't. I think that's pretty huge.
Now, this, let's be clear, this is the relative risk, the absolute risk that any person will get melanoma from a tanning bed exposure is small. But why would you want to increase that risk at all? Especially for teenagers, I think the pediatricians are saying, look, that these are minors. It's up to us to make a decision like this. Society should make this decision. There are lots of state rules that that don't allow this, but they're really going the whole way and saying it should just be blanket, no way. And I'm not sure that the actions the FDA is contemplating are going to go that far, but we'll find out.
So speaking of what they're looking at, last June, we took a closer look at the dangers of indoor tanning with a piece by Patty Naimond. We've pulled it out of the archives, and let's take a listen.
It was right before the prom 8 years ago. 17-year-old Brittany Sakala was really excited. She was going with the boy she would eventually marry, and her dress, well, it was beautiful. Delicately beaded lace and spaghetti straps and elegant A-line in white.
Everyone around me was telling me, man, you would look so much better with a tan, and your teeth would look whiter, your acne would go away.
So pale-skinned Brittany did what lots of her friends did. She did what a lot of teens in the U.S. do. She went to a tanning salon. In fact, she went to the salon 5, 6, often 7 days a week and lay in the tanning bed for 20 to 25 minutes each time.
I called myself a tanorexic because I would look into the mirror and never see myself as dark as other people would see me, much as an anorexic would never see themselves as thin as other people would see them. So I kept going.
Tanorexic? Yes. That's what a study from psychologist Catherine Mosher of Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center recently confirmed. Mosher analyzed data from more than 420 college students and had them answer questions typically used to screen for alcohol and substance abuse, but modified to ask about tanning habits.
Do you try to cut down on the time you spend in tanning beds or booths, but find yourself still tanning? Do you ever feel guilty that you're using tanning beds or booths too much?
Mosher found the majority of kids answered yes to one or more of these questions, which target addictive behavior. After 3 years of routine indoor tanning, Brittany Sakala ended up with a serious health problem.
My mom noticed a mole on my back about the size of a nickel the summer of 2004. She kept bugging me about it. Brittany, that doesn't look right. You really should go get that checked out.
But Brittany stalled and kept tanning. Then the mole started to bleed. Her doctor took one look at the mole and scheduled a biopsy for the next morning. Brittany had melanoma, the most aggressive form of skin cancer. 2 weeks later, she had surgery to remove the mole, which left a 7-inch scar. Since then, Brittany's had 34 surgeries to remove suspicious moles. Robin Hornung is a pediatric dermatologist in Washington State. She says rates of melanoma are growing fastest among younger women, 15 to 29 years old, and researchers want to understand why.
The question is, why is that happening? But a lot of folks would point to perhaps indoor tanning. That's the group that makes up most of the indoor tanners are the young women.
Federal officials say as many as 1 in 5 teenagers, mostly girls, have used a tanning bed over the past year. And while teens may think of a tan as a healthy glow, Hornung says it's the body's reaction to injury.
We know that a tan is really your skin's response to ultraviolet light damage. DNA breaks. There are mutations in the DNA. And when you get breaking of the DNA, you actually have a tan is a kind of a healing response.
A recent study found melanoma risk increased as much as 3 times if people tanned indoors more than 50 hours in their lifetime or had more than 100 sessions in a tanning booth. The World Health Organization recently classified tanning beds as carcinogenic and recommended children under 18 be banned from using them. A number of countries have already put such bans in place, and the Food and Drug Administration, which regulates the tanning industry in the U.S., says it's also considering a ban. FDA official Sharon Miller says the agency definitely plans to strengthen warning labels on the beds themselves.
We're planning to use a bulleted format and just be more direct and say that UV can cause skin cancer, you know, not draw it out and make it seem like only people who really abuse it are going to get skin cancer, because we think any exposure does contribute to your risk of skin cancer.
The FDA may also require parents to approve tanning for kids under 18. John Overstreet with the Indoor Tanning Association says bans are intrusive and represent overregulation.
I think the industry is a great deal more professional than it was 25 years ago. So there's a lot of information available to these businesses that allow them to advise people about how long they should be in the tanning bed without getting overexposed.
Meanwhile, since her own illness, cancer survivor Brittany Sakala has made skin cancer awareness her personal mission. She's testified about tanning and cancer risk at FDA hearings and at medical conferences. But by far the most important work she does, says Sakala, is at local high schools where she tells young girls her story about indoor tanning and cancer. Patty Niemand, NPR News.
And now, silent speech. German researchers are developing a way to translate the movements of the face into computer-generated speech. Their system could make it possible for people to teach computers to read lips. Reporter Gretchen Kudu-Crowen has the story of how one man might be helped by the new technology.
16 years ago, Al Canada lost his vocal cords and his voice to cancer. In the beginning, he communicated with a whiteboard and a pen, then with something called an electrolarynx.
I used this for 3 years before I got my voice prosthesis. It was a barrel of laughs.
Today, Canada speaks a lot better. He has a voice prosthesis, a small valve surgically inserted into an opening in his throat. When he speaks, he holds his thumb across the opening and uses his breath to force air upwards through his throat and mouth to form speech. But even this prosthesis isn't perfect. His voice is raspy, and he speaks a bit slower than he used to because he has to take a breath in between each phrase. And certain sounds still elude him, like the letter H.
Owls, O's, hiccup. Everything else you can pretty well do, but the letter H is a bother.
A couple of weeks ago at a scientific conference in Washington, D.C., German researchers showed off something that might work even better for Canada. Once it's perfected, that is. German researcher Michael Vant demonstrated the system for me.
Let us have dinner at the pub.
Let us have dinner at the pub.
A good time would be 7 o'clock.
A good time would be 7 o'clock.
For his PhD thesis at the Karlsruhe Institute of Technology, Vant developed a way to translate the movements of the face into speech. Right now, the device is a half dozen or so wires connecting electrodes on Vant's face to a computer. The idea is that a person can silently form the words they want to say, not actually speak them, as Vant had to do when demonstrating for radio, and the computer interprets the muscle movements and turns them into sound. But there's still a lot to do. For example, what girl would say yes to a pub dinner with a guy who has electrodes all over his face? Vant agrees and says one day the electrodes and the software will be completely integrated into a smartphone that could be held discreetly to the side of the face and produce fluent speech. Vant says the system currently recognizes about 2,000 words and operates with 90% accuracy. Good enough for everyday speech, he says. Well, at least most of the time.
My name is Michael Wand.
I would be glad to.
Yeah, was just another try. So the recognizer interprets my muscle movements.
The recognizer interprets my muscle.
Therefore, I can talk to you by simply mouthing words.
Sure you can get my data.
Okay, so not perfect.
No idea what's happening. Maybe it's getting a bit late. Electrodes falling off.
Vant tells me that sometimes smiling and other nonverbal facial movements can confuse the system. But who knows? Maybe it's good enough to be used by reporters with stuffy noses.
For NPR News, I'm Gretchen Kudu-Crowen in Cleveland.
And that's all for Your Health, NPR's weekly health podcast. We had a production assistance from our fabulous intern, Adam Cole.
And our health blogger is...
Scott Hensley!
Yay! And you can read Scott's blog at npr.org/shots. So we'll be back again next week, and thanks for listening.
See ya.